the Taliban blamed the United States for the chaotic evacuation from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Iraq says at least two civilians have been killed in its northern Kurdistan region by a Turkish army bombardment. Iran's President Raisi tells the Japanese foreign minister that the delay in releasing Tehran's frozen funds is unjustified. Marzia Hashimi, thanks so much for being with us. Well, a senior Taliban official says the United States is to blame for the chaotic evacuation of tens of thousands of locals and foreigners from the Afghan capital. The official said there is calm all over Afghanistan except Kabul Airport, where the U.S. has failed to bring order. The airport has seen chaotic scenes following the Taliban's takeover of the capital last Sunday. Thousands of people wary to live under Taliban rule are trying to get evacuation flights out of Afghanistan. A NATO official says at least 20 people have died in and around Kabul's airport over the last week. Witnesses have said some were shot and others died in stampedes. The airport is being patrolled by 6,000 heavily armed U.S. troops. Meanwhile, the U.S. says it has secured the capacity to help Americans flying out of Afghanistan. The U.S. National Security Advisor said his country has secured large masses of Americans' safe passage through the Kabul airport and onto the airfield. Jake Sullivan said the threat of Daesh terrorists against Americans and Afghans at the airport is real and acute. The U.S. says 18 commercial aircraft would be used to help transport people who have already been evacuated from Afghanistan. It has urged its citizens in the country to avoid traveling to the Kabul airport due to potential security threats. The U.S. seeks to evacuate 15,000 Americans and up to 60,000 Afghans by August the 31st. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has heavily criticized his successor, Joe Biden, for the way he handled U.S. troops' exit from Afghanistan.
Biden failed totally on the pandemic, and he's now overseeing the greatest foreign policy humiliation in the history of the United States of America. This is the greatest humiliation I've ever seen. Biden's botched exit in Afghanistan is the most astonishing display of gross incompetence by a nation's leader, perhaps at any time that anybody's ever seen. Name another situation like this.
Trump made the comments during a rally in Alabama. He said the U.S. pullout has to go down in history as one of the greatest military defeats of all time and said it was a total surrender. Trump said the quick takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban would not have happened if he had still been in office. Biden, however, argues that he inherited a bad withdrawal agreement from Trump. Meanwhile, the Taliban say they plan to unveil a new model for governing Afghanistan within the next few weeks. They also emphasize the importance of holding a wide range of consultations with other political leaders. Well, the move has been welcomed by political circles in Afghanistan. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. this will not happen. They warn, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by the members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Local officials in northern Iraq say two civilians have been killed in a Turkish army bombardment there. Officials said the Turkish attack hit the border district of Zakhov in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. They said the victims were not from the area but were caught in the Turkish bombing and died. Ensuing clashes have been reported. Turkey regularly targets northwest Iraq in operations against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. Ankara considers the group a terrorist organization. Iraq has time and again condemned the Turkish military operations as a violation of its sovereignty. And now to Iran, where President Ebrahim Raisi has called on Japan to release Iranian funds blocked in Japanese banks because of U.S. sanctions. Raisi said the delay in the release of the assets is unjustified. He made the remarks in a meeting with Japan's foreign minister, Motaki Toshimitsu, in Tehran. President Raisi also spoke about the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He said Iran has fulfilled its obligations while the U.S. and Europe have failed to meet their commitments. The top Japanese diplomat said his country has always supported the Iran deal. He said the full implementation of the accord is in favor of everyone. The Iranian president and the Japanese foreign minister also discussed other issues, including the situation in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Iran's parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a second day. Lawmakers are reviewing the qualifications of Raisi's picks for ministerial posts. Supporters and opponents of the nominees are given the stage to speak for or against them. This ahead of a vote of confidence that is expected to take place on Wednesday. And the Iranian president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement in case any of the proposed ministers fails to win the vote.
The second day of the confidence vote sessions in Iran's parliament started with reviewing the credentials of Ebrahim Raisi's pick for ICT Minister Issa Zarepour. As is the rule, two pros and two cons speak for or against the nominee, who will then defend his credentials for 30 minutes.
I am proud to announce that during my term in the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, I launched hundreds of science-based firms. Thanks to these efforts in 2011, we exported $20 million worth of software to other countries.
Mr. Zarepour does not have the expertise to run the ICT ministry. Furthermore, he does not have a fixed approach toward Parliament's bill on the protection of cyberspace. He has repeatedly flip-flopped on the issue. Mr. Zarepour, I ask you to clarify your stance. Do you agree or disagree with the cyberspace protection bill?
For the cyberspace protection bill, the legislator refers to a controversial bill recently introduced in Parliament that seeks to fill the legal voids in the Internet. Some believe if passed into law, the new bill would restrict the activities of cyber users, and others say it would ensure the intellectual property of online businesses in Iran.
The bill is yet to be passed into law and is pending now. I think if it becomes law, it will organize cyberspace in our country. It will protect the rights of online users. It will prevent cyber crimes. Every country has such a law. It's for the good of our people.
I think the draft bill needs to be revised. I do agree that there are serious legal voids with regards to cyberspace in our country, but could the new bill be implemented in a way that it would not make people worry about their online activities?
The credentials of the proposed ministers of intelligence, economy, and health were also put to debate on Sunday. Parliament had scheduled to review at least 5 nominees each day to wrap up the process by Tuesday. But after 2 days, lawmakers have managed to examine only 5 of the 19 ministerial picks.
While lawmakers have vowed to wrap up the vote of confidence session swiftly, they're already behind schedule. They argue that this is because they're trying to be meticulous in studying the qualifications of the nominees. And this, they say, will lead to a new cabinet that has the least friction with people's representatives. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Now to Yemen, where a top Yemeni official has slammed the British presence in eastern Al-Mahra governorate, saying any form of former foreign presence in Yemen is rejected. The chief negotiator of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the nation believes armed struggle is necessary to expel all foreign forces. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, reports.
In an interview with the Al-Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdus Salam, said the UK presence on Yemen soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is the right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Al-Mahra governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Al-Mahra, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Al-Mahra or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdus Salam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition in the Western Governorate are equal to the size of 2 Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground, as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. The Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, Iran has logged 684 new COVID deaths during the past 24 hours. That's the country's highest daily death toll since the start of the pandemic. The latest deaths push Iran's total tally to over 102,000. The country on Sunday also registered more than 36,400 new daily cases. Its overall infections are now nearing 4.7 million. Iran has been grappling with a fifth wave of COVID-19 triggered by the Delta variant for several weeks now. The country launched a vaccination campaign in February, but it has been slowed mainly due to insufficient supplies. Tehran blames that on U.S. sanctions that have made it difficult to purchase vaccines from other countries. Well, the U.S. has imposed new sanctions on Russia over its Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project. The new measures target 2 Russian companies and a ship involved in the project. Analysts believe U.S. sanctions cannot stop the nearly completed project that would transfer Russian gas to Germany.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the whole pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for being with us.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. It starts like this. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, said, I leave two great and precious things among you, the Book of Allah and my household. Verily, these two will never be separated from each other until they encounter me at the pool of Kauthar in Paradise, the tradition of Thaghalain. Neither am I dealing with what has befallen upon humanity from its negligence and abandonment of true nature and stature of the greatest trust, the Holy Quran, and the greater trust, the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them, the latter being greatest of all entity, but the greatest trust, which is the absolute greatest. Nor do I recount here what has befallen the two trusts from the enemies of Allah and the tricky oppressors, who are too many for me to enumerate, given my limited knowledge and lack of time.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi. In the last episodes, we talked about one of the speeches of Imam Khomeini, peace and blessings on his soul, which was delivered in the west of Tehran on October 22, 1969. We talked about few important points. Today, we will talk about another important point. He was mentioning that we should let our children and youth not consider that this is only a mourning matter. Just think about it. If you will just cry and cry and cry, what is the end result? What are you getting? What are you benefiting from these cries? The best outcome, which should be from these cries, is that you start hating the oppressors, and then you should have an energy to fight against those oppressors.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
If you don't have this power against the oppressors, if you cannot fight bravely with them, then there is no result, then there is no perfect result for these cries. So Imam Khomeini mentions that this is our responsibility to tell our youth, to tell our children that these mourning sessions are not just for cries and lamentations, but these are basically to give us the energy and the power to fight against the oppressors of our time. As we know that the media against us always gives us the notion that we are the people of lamentation, that we are the people who are always crying. To one extent, this is fine. We are crying. There is no doubt about that. But our cries should be giving us the strength and the notion and the understanding that we must fight the oppressors of our time. This is the lesson for our young people. Thank you very much and see you in the next episode, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back. Iranians have serious grievances with regard to British policies, both in the past and in more recent years. The British boycott of Iran's central bank and its efforts in imposing economic sanctions on Iran was perhaps the latest chapter in the series of historical events that have put the two governments at odds with each other. But the roots of distrust are derived in large part from the harmful role Britain has historically played in Iran. And perhaps the confrontation over Anglo-Iranian oil came to define British-Iranian relations for the modern era. Most of this is put down to the reality of the Anglo-American intervention that facilitated the overthrow of Dr. Mossadegh's democratically elected government in the 1953 coup. Stay with us for the rest.
The British had to either play fair and witness the end of their fortunes in Iran, or somehow get rid of this man and his nationalistic ideas. It was an easy choice to make at the time, with the British intelligence service soon called into action.
Despite there not having been an official acknowledgement by the British government, one can go to the National Archives and certainly find traces of the original plan for the coup, which was essentially conceived by the British, initially, of course, as Operation Boot. It then gets rebranded as Operation Ajax after the Americans essentially take over operational control of it. But it's essentially conceived of by the British.
The British involvement in Iran and their influence towards the press, national opinion, in the parliament, and in different towns in Iran was very important and significant. They spent a lot of money for coup d'etat. The British agents and officials managed to convince the Americans that Mossadegh is not negotiable. And that was very helpful to have a coalition between the new conservative government of the United Kingdom as well as the new Republican government of the United States.
The coup d'etat to overthrow Mossadegh's government took place on the 19th of August 1953. Through CIA and MI6 engineered protests and bribery of Iranian officers.
If one looks at the kind of paper trail, there are a number of individuals who I suppose are influential in helping the sort of genesis of the coup, notably Christopher Woodhouse, an MI6 agent, but also Anne Lambton, who was of course a scholar of Persian studies, was employed by Foreign Office for a time as well. So it's this group of individuals in the Foreign Office and indeed MI6 who eventually, of course, go on to essentially influence or perhaps prey upon American communist paranoia, particularly so that the Americans eventually, of course, decide to implement the operation after the British are expelled from the country by Dr. Mossadegh. On the grounds, of course, that they are in fact plotting to overthrow him.
This has rankled ever since with ordinary Iranians, seeing it as an unacceptable interference in the affairs of their country. For most people in this country, that's not only not a distant memory, it's something that most people know nothing about.
For decades after the overthrow of Mossadegh, Britain enjoyed having Mohammad Reza Shah ruling Iran, supporting him unreservedly despite his coercive and tyrannical methods.
The British supported the Pahlavi regime and certainly were very involved in backing Mohammad Reza Shah's claim to the throne of Iran and to a kind of absolute monarchy on the basis that he more effectively represented Western interests in Iran.
Britain was certainly a supporter of the Shah, as was virtually every other Western country in the period when he was on the Peacock throne. The British saw him as the guarantor of stability in the Gulf. Everybody remembers the phrase, the policeman of the Gulf. Iran was an important market for Britain, for other European countries.
The Shah was the main ally of the West in the Middle East during a period where the fear of the West was the fear of the Soviet Union and expansion of communism in different parts of the world. The Shah was obviously a bulwark of the security arrangements worldwide, but in particular in the Middle East of the West.
The British involvement in bringing the Shah to power and their sustained support made him a very close friend and ally. Nicholas Barrington was the head of the British mission in Iran immediately after the revolution. He speaks to us about how Britain struggled to keep the Shah in power.
People began to realize that the situation, the public opinion was growing up very much against the Shah. And I think the British, as far as I remember, were telling the Shah not to be too tough with these people. I mean, there were some around the Shah who said, let's, you know, kill them all and so on, be too tough. And I think we were saying, you know, be moderate to get someone, because it would be in our interest to have an Iran that was working smoothly, of whatever political background, with which we could trade and do dealings.
With the Shah in power, they're of course able to sell vast amounts of arms to him. Ultimately, the Shah ends up with, I think, more Chieftain tanks than, in fact, the British armed forces possess. And so the British do, in that sense, have a kind of economic interest in keeping the Shah in power.
As the Islamic Revolution of 1979 gathered pace, Britain failed to understand the signals coming from Iran and continued to support the Shah until his very last days.
They undermined the religious leadership, especially Ayatollah Khomeini's leadership, and they didn't understand how they are important to influence the hearts and minds of the public opinion in Iran. You can see the British government always relied on the reports on their ambassador in Iran, Sir Anthony Parsons, and they thought the Shah is very powerful, and for the British interest is good to not criticize the Shah foreign policies and human rights policies because of keeping the business activities of the British government in Iran.
I was a teenager, I didn't know much about Iran, but Iran was seen as a developing Western-style country, and people really turned that, closed their eyes to the fact that it wasn't remotely democratic. And of course, as the Shah got older and the internal difficulties he faced increased, then SADC, the secret police, became more and more unpleasant in their dealings with people to repress internal opposition. The great mistake that was made by British diplomats in Tehran and to some extent in the British Foreign Office was that they failed to read the signs of coming turbulence until it was too late. So they were briefing the British Foreign Minister until the last moment to say that the Shah would survive. When it said, I wasn't there, but it seems to me, looking at all the history of it, that perfectly obvious that this was a regime in its death throes, as we say, and it would have been far better if we and other friendly countries had said to the Shah, it is time for you to go.
It's well known, or perhaps well known to people like me who are interested, that until 1978, until almost the last moment before the revolution, the British ambassador in Tehran described Iran as being a bastion of stability, and that there was no prospect in view that the Shah would be overthrown. So they not only supported the Shah until the very end, but they were also quite wrong about the balance of forces until the very last minute before the Islamic Revolution.
Being a close ally of Britain did not spare the Shah from their harm. In 1971, Britain orchestrated the independence of Bahrain from Iran through a survey of the Bahraini population.
Iran was defeated to approve his claims, his historical and legal claims to ownership of Bahrain. And virtually the British government deceived Iran on that. Iran, under pressure of international community, accepted the referendum in Bahrain, but the British government actually pursued the Al-Khalifa clan in Bahrain to not doing any referendum and just had a very fabricated information gathering, and they called that referendum. That was a fabricated referendum, and Iran had to accept that, although it wasn't in the agreement of Iran and the United Kingdom. So Bahrain became independent, and Iran had to accept that, and Iran couldn't follow its historical claims on the ownership of Bahrain. And practically more than two-thirds of Shi'i original Iranian Bahrainis became under the control of the migrant minority of Sunni rulers. And that was the act of British government. And Iranians always thought that was the fault of the British to terminate Iranians' claim to Bahrain.
The arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini to the political scene after the revolution posed many challenges to the interests of Western countries in Iran.
When the Shah left and Ayatollah Khomeini came, we had to work out how to get established relations with the new regime. And for a long time, all people around the world didn't know how to do that.
When the Shah was removed by the revolution, obviously that was upturning the whole security arrangements that the West and the United States had. So obviously that was, at that time, their initial reaction. I think the tragedy is that the West was not able to get on with the Islamic Republic, and relations deteriorated so much after that.
With Iran engulfed in difficulties after the revolution and defying Western hegemony in the region, some saw an opportunity to put an end to the newly established Islamic Republic once and for all. It was Iraq's ruler, Saddam Hussein, who took the initiative, starting an all-out war against Iran. A war that would become the longest conventional war in the 20th century. Britain, as many other Western powers, claimed neutrality during that war.
I was a member of the British government during the Iran-Iraq war, and our policy was to supply nothing to either side. And I was a minister, and we were always having to make marginal decisions about, you know, was a sailing boat something that had a military purpose? If someone wanted to buy a sailing boat in Iraq, could we justify that or not? You know, some of these decisions were not very easy, but I know, as a member of the British government at the time, the attitude was one of studied, deliberate neutrality. But I know a lot of Iranians don't really believe that.
It was later understood, however, that guidelines had been established by the British government in keeping neutrality, but were not necessarily followed.
Having lost, as it were, influence within Iran, although, as usual in a post-revolutionary situation, it was very turbulent. I mean, you never quite know what's going to happen, because revolutions are chaotic. But Britain and the West really saw Iraq as a means of containing the Iranian revolution. And so a blind eye effectively was turned when the Saddam Hussein regime launched what amounts to an unprovoked attack on Iranian interests in the south.
I think it's quite clear that Britain, during the Iran-Iraq war, was much more supportive of Saddam Hussein than it was of the Islamic Republic. It professed, of course, to be neutral, as did many countries, but of course we know that in secret there were British weapons exports to Iraq during that period, something that wasn't clear at the time but came out later and was the subject of much criticism. And broadly speaking, it's no secret that Western countries supported, either mostly passively, to some degree occasionally actively, the Iraqi war effort against Iran.
One specific case of Britain's active support for the Iraqi war efforts against Iran relates to the sale of British Chieftain tanks to Saddam Hussein, a dispute which is still pursued by the Islamic Republic.
Chieftain tanks after the revolution again became problematic. The British government took the money many years before revolution by at the time of the Shah, but stopped giving them to Iran. Then, first of all, because of the revolution, they said, we are not going to give it to you some of the money. Then after U.S. Embassy saga, they said, we are not going to give it. And then the third excuse was the starting of Iran-Iraq war. Okay, they said we have international obligation to not giving this chieftain's thanks to Iran anymore. They took money, they should give the money back. They didn't give the money back. But at the same time, when the Iran and Iraq both had been sanctioned and they should be treated at the same situation, again with highest possible dishonesty, the British government sold, they already sold the Iranian tanks to Jordan and Iraq, and gave the Iranian tanks to Iran's enemy, although Iraq was under sanction as well, same as Iran in the war.
Documents suggest that not only did Britain resell the Iranian-owned tanks to Saddam Hussein, but also sent servicemen to Iraq in order to repair any damaged tanks.
They excuse that we cannot help Iranian, we cannot give anything to Iranian, but practically they were helping Iraq for that. And you can see the documents on Chieftain Saga reselling the Iranian tanks who already been paid many years ago to the Iraqis and Jordanians, as well as repairing them in favor of the Iraqis in Iraqi lands.
British companies were also involved in providing assistance to the Iraqi regime in order to produce chemical weapons, and this was done with the knowledge of the British government.
I believe that if you look at the list of Iranian complaints against Britain and other Western countries, I think the most justified complaint is indeed on that point, because it's not that long ago that the cost of that war was a terrible one, and there was a policy in the West generally, supported by the Israelis for their own reasons, that did tilt, certainly to use that word, towards the Iraqi side.
More than two decades after the war, the gridlock between the Islamic Republic and the West did not start to look less tense. The Iranian peaceful nuclear energy program caused even more tension between the two sides. With the absence of the United States around the negotiating table, Britain initially spearheaded diplomatic efforts.
What I can say, and it's very important to say this, was that the idea of negotiating with Iran over the nuclear dossier rather than confronting Iran was an idea which came from three European foreign ministers, from Dominique de Villepin, who was the French foreign minister at the time, from Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, and from me. And the Americans were not involved at that stage, and indeed elements in the American administration, like Don Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, were hostile to what we were doing. So sensible Iranians, including people like the now foreign minister Zarif Mousavian, and Dr. Rouhani, who was the man across the table from us, as well as Kamal Karazi, recognized that we were their three foreign ministers, their best hope for solving this issue in a sensible way.
However, the attitude assumed in the negotiations by Europe, led by Britain, was at times even tougher than the American position, and aimed to stop Iran from pursuing any nuclear activity. This was accomplished by harsh sanctions against the Islamic Republic, adding fuel to the already antagonistic feeling of Iranians towards the UK.
While there were countries in Europe that did not want to wreck Iran-EU relations, countries like Germany, most of Southern Europe, the British were very heavily involved, and the British representatives in Brussels as well in the EU, they played a very effective role in the demonization of Iran and in creating hostility towards Iran among policymakers in the EU. And they did this alongside the United States. And of course, there were other lobbies, such as the Saudi-Israeli lobby. But the British played a very effective role.
The sanctions created many difficulties for the civilian population of Iran, including access to important pharmaceuticals and medical equipment.
The lack of medicines, which when talking to people I know who have relatives in Iran, quite shocking, the basic inability because of sanctions to access Western drugs, pharmaceuticals, and Western technology here.
Sanctions, yes, were costly, created lots of problems for us, but they never be able to bring Iran to its knees. They wanted to impose crippling sanctions. It never worked. So I think it was, it became crystal clear for everybody that Iran would never give up its rights because of sanctions, because of pressures, because of threats. And we were ready to stand for all of them.
Sanctions which affect the whole-scale population of civilians, it's a retribution against against civilians, which after 1945, the Second World War, was made illegal. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there is a case for saying the damage inflicted on a civilian population by these wholesale sanctions can be regarded as a crime against humanity.
In August 2015, the two countries decided to put aside their differences and their troubled history by reopening their embassies.
I'm proud to declare this embassy once again open.
But should historical events be addressed if Iran and Britain were to enjoy good relations in the future?
Following the announcement of the restoration of relations between Iran and Britain, the new Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, made quite clear that the British government, in fact, had no intention of acknowledging its role in Iranian domestic affairs over the past century. And I think there was a sense, from his perspective at least, that history was too fraught, perhaps, to delve into in any detail. But my sense would be is that he perhaps ought to acknowledge it.
Whatever the future holds for diplomatic relations between the UK and Iran, it will be based on an understanding of a long historical relationship, both what happened during the past century and, more importantly, the very history being made today. Perhaps only time will show if Iranians should still perceive Britain as the old fox, cunning and sly. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again next week here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.